The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. 'Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. On today's episode, I'm very pleased to be joined by John Cook, the creator of the website Skeptical Science. John's made it his mission to examine each individual argument that claims to refute man-made global warming. We'll find out which claims are supported by scientific evidence and which are simply hot air. It's been a banner week here at Skeptically Speaking. We have four new stations to say hello to. May I introduce you to CHMR 93.5 FM in St. John's, Newfoundland, 92.5 The X in Kamloops, British Columbia, CFBI 97.7 FM in Cambridge Bay, Nunavut, and CHSR 97.9 FM in Fredericton, New Brunswick. Thanks very much to all of our new rebroadcasters. We're happy to have you on Team Science. And I'd like to give a special shout out to the program director at CHSR, Tom Richmond. He backed us at CJAI out of Stella, Ontario, and brought us along when he moved to CHSR. Thanks, Tom. We appreciate the support. And now, to Speaking Up. We're here today with Meg Askey, director of the Flagstaff Film Festival. Meg is an artist and designer who has audaciously decided to produce a film festival in Flagstaff, Arizona. Thanks for being here, Meg.
Thanks so much, Desiree. It's great to talk to you.
So tell us about the festival.
Well, it's an opportunity for me to get a bunch of different kinds of people together. I have a lot of friends and colleagues that I've come together with over the years that make media and art. I wanted to have a place for them to come together and collaborate. And I also wanted to reach out to people outside of film and art and media in order to make some exciting programs that were a little bit different than what you might find at other film festivals.
And this is the first year of the festival.
Yeah, it is. And I'm a little exhausted. Can you hear it in my voice?
Totally understood. So there's three programs to the festival. There's road movies, immigration and border issues, and scientific exploration and inquiry.
Yep.
So that's an interesting combination.
Yeah. And in fact, we've added another one. I'm trying to watch some of the films that have already been submitted. And we're accepting submissions, by the way, through the end of June. So I'm trying to tailor to what the filmmakers are making, but I also want to encourage filmmaking in areas that I'm personally interested in.
Are those categories what you're personally interested in then?
The one that I'm most particularly interested in is the science and skepticism. That's a personal interest to me. And I figured since I was putting a lot of my own blood, sweat, and tears into this, I would go into a direction that I felt extremely passionate about.
Why is that?
Why am I passionate about it?
Absolutely.
Well, you know, when I went back to school for the second time, I'm one of those people, you know, I went back to study media and filmmaking. And as an artist, one of the things that maybe scientific kind of people don't quite understand is that the words "you have to take algebra" are so extremely frightening. So I decided that I was going to figure out how not to do that. So what I could do instead was take logic and critical thinking. And taking that class in college changed my life. Figuring out that people knew how to explain the world, that the default of magical thinking was a fallacy. These things really changed my life. And I think that if more people were thinking critically, our world would be a more delightful place. So I'd like to help in my own little teeny weeny way relieve the world of their devotion to magical thinking.
You are warming the cockles of my heart.
Am I really?
You are.
Awesome.
Now, you sent me a phrase that I actually like very much. We find truth through scientific exploration, but we find understanding through artistic expression. So is this kind of what this track is based on?
Yes, definitely. I love the work of filmmakers who are somehow able to help me open my eyes and go, man, I can't believe that that world exists. I think of filmmakers like Werner Herzog, whose film Encounters at the End of the World made me so thrilled with the kind of exploration and scientific research that's going on at the North Pole or the South Pole. You know, see, that's where I'm not a scientist. I'm like, it's one of those poles.
It's cold there, I hear.
It's cold and icy. And it looked cool. But to be able to encourage that kind of filmmaking is of great interest to me, and it helps people understand what's happening. Since our very beginnings, people have been painting on the walls of caves. So I think that if we find ourselves in a situation as we have down here, your southern friend in the United States, you know, we've found ourselves wondering, what are people thinking in Kansas that we're questioning the theory of evolution in our schools? Right. So to me, when we confront the idea that there are people that don't understand that evolution is indisputable, I have to think, as an artist, that we've failed in how we draw that picture on the cave wall. I want to help in some way.
I think that's actually that's a wonderful way to explain science communication, because that's really what you're talking about here, is you're doing science communication.
Right. I want to support scientists in whatever I can. And I can't do the research. I wanted to get out of even taking algebra. But what I can do is help scientists contact people who make media and tell their stories better.
Now, you're looking for submissions. So what exactly are you looking for?
Well, what I ideally like is to have that film that I go, oh my gosh, I cannot believe the inside of a cave looks like that. I want my mind to be blown. But a little bit more precisely, what I'd like to see is people who are taking on tough topics and explaining them to the layperson, people who are interested in any kind of scientific theory, string theory. Tell me what that is, people.
We would all like that.
Yeah, I would love to have somebody explain to me what that is, just in a little way. I get that it's multifaceted and things, but just one wee way, please help my tiny brain. So, you know, to encourage that kind of curiosity in people, if you work at a university and you're a filmmaker at that university, walk down to the next building. There are people doing hard science. Make your film about that for your senior thesis. You don't need to make it about the battle of good and evil when you've got some real hard science happening right next door.
So have you received any particularly interesting submissions like this so far?
There have been some submissions that are fitting in quite nicely. There's one in particular that I just accepted, which was not what I thought some of the submissions were going to be, but was nonetheless really, it flipped some of the switches for me about science and discovery. And it's a film called Hillman's Bones, directed by some people in Colorado. And it's about searching for the real identity of somebody who was suspected of committing a crime. So it's a documentary using scientific research in order to uncover the real identity of this person. And it's a fascinating trip that they take.
So the lineup, eventually when it's done, will all be independent films?
Yes, they'll all be independent films, many of them that have not found distribution yet. So part of the purpose of a film festival is to find distribution for independent films.
You also mentioned workshops and panels. Are any set up yet?
We are hoping that we can work very closely with our local observatory, Lowell Observatory, which is where Pluto was discovered. So we already have a lot of passion in Flagstaff, as you can imagine, because of the Pluto situation.
I was going to say, Arizona likes its controversy.
Oh, we do. We will fight for anything. Like, it's the Old West. We all consider ourselves to be either Wild Bill Hickok or Annie Oakley. That's not true. But certainly there's a controversy in Flagstaff about the demotion of Pluto. So I'm hoping that we can talk to the community about why this has happened, this modern day tragedy, but also use our interest in such things for looking at some new facts.
Now that would make a brilliant film.
You are so right. I'm going to write a grant as soon as we're done chatting. Like, how devoted Flagstaff is to this. You're spot on.
Well, in addition to the Pluto controversy, which is obviously quite important, there's also controversy about Arizona's new immigration laws.
And, there absolutely is.
Right. So since there's been a boycott of the state, do you think that's going to affect your festival at all?
Well, as soon as the local media started talking about that immigration debate, as an owner of a new business, of course, I had a wee panic attack. But I decided that it was another opportunity to talk about immigration and border issues. And so we also have, in addition to our scientific inquiry film program, we have a program about immigration and border issues. And I'm hoping that we can also see all kinds of films that talk about what Arizonans feel about the issue. And I wanted to be able to say to cities who have boycotted us, hey, you know, why don't you come and talk to us about what your feelings are? Let's use this as an opportunity to learn from one another rather than the decision you can make where a person or a city or a state or a country is good or evil. So let's try to be a little bit more adult than that and have a conversation rather than act out of haste.
That's interesting. So it seems like the Flagstaff Film Festival is about critical analysis across the board, not just scientific skepticism.
You know, I need to have you write my press release because you have been able to distill that in a way that I have not yet been able to. So yeah, I think it is. I would really rather use art and filmmaking as a way to understand our world. I think people need to be brought together more right now than be polarized.
When's the festival?
The festival, it takes place over a week's time in August 9th through the 16th, in beautiful, cool, and piney Flagstaff, Arizona, which is only 80 miles from the Grand Canyon, people. You might be there anyway.
I am very much encouraging anybody who's listening who is a filmmaker to get involved in this. I think this is a brilliant idea. And quite honestly, I don't think we... Are there other skeptical film festivals that I am not aware of?
I think there are a few, and I think that the TED people try to do a lot of exploration of, you know, filmmaking and technology and design sort of issues, but I don't know that there are people who are as willing to... You know, it's a political thing to go out and say, hey, I'm into not talking about the magical ways of thinking. I don't think a lot of people want to come out and say that.
But this is the thing. We can make this entertaining. We can make science accessible in a way that people actually want to know more, not that they feel like they're forced to know more.
Right. And a lot of the films I've already seen are comedies. You know, you can deal comedically about our belief systems and when we need to maybe rethink them a little or have a sense of humor about why we think the way that we do and be critical about it.
I think this is a fantastic idea. So very much good luck with it. Very, very much. And
thank
I say
you
that
so much.
Good luck in a completely symbolic way.
Wonderful. And I will be sure to let you know how things go. I thank you so much for your time and interest.
Absolutely. Where can people find out more?
They can find out more at www.flagstafffilmfestival.org. And we're also on all the places, the Twitter and the Facebook and all of those wonderful places. So
I'd also like to point out that you have a gorgeous website.
Well, thank you so much. It was the very first opportunity as a designer that I've had to actually design the website I wanted to design.
Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, too.
And now we have a special action alert with Michael Cruz, co-chair for the Center for Inquiry's Committee for the Advancement of Scientific Skepticism. Welcome, Michael.
Well, hello. How are you today? Thank you for having me on the show.
No problem at all. You're here with a bit of a call to arms.
Yeah. Deepak Chopra, author of over 50 books, was scheduled to speak in Toronto on June the 23rd. He's a sort of new age modern mystic and has been described, according to his website, by Time magazine as one of the top 100 heroes and icons of the century, and they credit him as the poet prophet of alternative medicine. So, of course, our hackles raise at that last quote.
Right.
He's basically co-opted quantum theory, Hindu, Buddhist, and Christian myths, and attempted to fashion sort of a new philosophy out of it, and had been very commercially successful at it. To that end, we were, of course, very surprised to find out that his talk in Toronto was to be sponsored or be presented by the Royal Ontario Museum as a part of their director's series of lectures in support of a new exhibit called The Warrior Emperor and China's Terracotta Army. This was very surprising to us, as the ROM is an excellent scientific institution with a very long history of supporting good science. And we chose at the committee to let them know that we were a bit disappointed. To that end, we drafted an open letter and solicited signatures from the scientific community, from the skeptical community, and we got over 800 of them in over a weekend. We have yet to present that to them. We're still collating the signatures, but we'd like to ask people if they are able to tell the ROM how they feel about this. But we're sort of trying to solicit people's interest in sending letters and letting the board of directors know at the ROM that a scientific institution like the ROM really shouldn't be supporting the pseudoscience of Deepak Chopra.
Now, this event has been postponed.
It has. The G20 is in Toronto at the end of June, and the University of Toronto has decided to suspend all campus activities for that week. So the event has been postponed. It hasn't been rescheduled as of yet, and we took this as an opportunity for the ROM to maybe rethink Mr. Chopra's kind of presence in their director's series of lectures.
So you would like to turn this postponement into a cancellation?
A cancellation would be great. We think that'd be a win for us. Now, that being said, we don't want to censor Mr. Chopra. Freedom of speech is a very important value, and I think held to the highest esteem by skeptics in support of scientific inquiry, in support of critical thinking. And he certainly doesn't need the ROM's help to present his views. He's a very successful entrepreneur, and having the ROM be a part of this sullies the ROM more than anything else, right? Mr. Chopra, I'm sure, is able to present his views in a forum on his own kind of merits as opposed to being supported by the Royal Ontario Museum.
I would say, additionally, we don't want to lend scientific credibility by default just due to a choice in venue.
Yeah, I agree. He's got some wacky ideas, let's put it that way. The ones where he musts the most aren't his sort of philosophical ideas, but the ones where he tries to co-opt quantum theory into explaining his philosophy and his Buddhist or Hindu ideas.
Right.
Most importantly, because it's not science, right? It's religion. He's a great proponent of Ayurvedic medicine, which sort of eschews the scientific method to prove its methods. Big proponent of transcendental meditation.
Right.
Two things which are fine, I imagine, in a philosophical sense, but certainly not scientific.
And this is the thing. If people haven't studied physics in any way, they can absolutely mistakenly believe that the use of quantum in these conversations is somehow based in science, which it is not.
Absolutely. He tends to string a whole bunch of science-y words together, which sound very impressive and are quite poetic at times. But they don't mean anything scientifically. When scientists listen to him, they sort of shake their head and wonder what he just said. One of the big claims he makes is that if your consciousness is not appreciating an object, it doesn't exist. Which is no better than saying, if I close my eyes and don't see you, then you disappear. It's a child's argument, really, and it's not science.
So, again, what would you like people to do?
Take this opportunity, if you can, to drop a letter to the Royal Ontario Museum, either to their board of directors or public affairs department. The snail mail address is 100 Queen's Park in Toronto, Ontario, Mike 5 Sam 2 Charlie 6. Their main switchboard number is 416-586-8000. We're going to be sending our communications to the board through their email address, certainly, before we present them with the letter physically. The board director's email address is board, B-O-A-R-D, at rom.on.ca. So if you have displeasure at this, please voice your displeasure at the ROM and let them know what the skeptical and scientific community feels about their presentation of Mr. Deepak Chopra.
And if people want to find out about this online?
Yeah, we're going to be publishing certainly an open letter online. With the signatures, we think they're going to be made public, the ones that we can make public. At the CFI Canada blog, which is cficanada.ca/blogs. Certainly check in there for updates. We'll also be publishing some refutations of his claims, his medical claims, and his pseudoscientific claims there as well in the coming weeks.
Great. Thanks very much for being here, Michael.
Well, thank you very much, Desiree. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely. And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. After the show, continue the conversation in the comments section of the website, or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of wonderful radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm on the line with John Cook. John studied physics at the University of Queensland in Australia, and after graduating, he majored in solar physics. He founded the Skeptical Science website in 2007 when he began a database to keep track of the peer-reviewed science on various global warming skeptic arguments. The website has expanded since then to include rebuttals to over 100 of the most popular skeptic arguments. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, John.
Hi.
So what do you mean by climate change skeptics? Because when I use the term skeptic, I mean one who is committed to basing their beliefs and opinions on scientific evidence and critical analysis.
Yes, I'm not quite sure that it's exactly the same thing in terms of global warming skeptics. I guess a global warming skeptic is just someone who is skeptical that humans are causing climate change. Most of them would say they're not skeptical that climate is changing, just that humans are influencing it.
So to clarify then, you're speaking about skeptics who have gone past the questioning and straight into not accepting the science.
Yeah, I guess there's many ways that they can get to that point. A friend of mine is a very strong skeptic, and when I asked him why, he said he likes big cars and he hates the idea that the government's going to come in and tell him he can't have a big car. And my father-in-law, he's a skeptic, and his reason is because he thinks there's a one-world government that's going to try and take away our freedom, and somehow global warming is all part of that. So you know, there's various ways that people get to that position, and I'm not sure that science is often the way that they get there, I guess.
Interesting. But Skeptical Science, the website, tries to examine every single one of the skeptical arguments.
If I could have maybe 5 or 6 times as many hours in a day, then yeah, there's so many arguments that are I guess listed in our database, and I just get through the most popular ones. What I'm trying to do is, I guess, from the way I think about it, science is skeptical by nature. Like, that's what science is. And to me, skepticism is considering the full body of evidence before you come to a conclusion. And so that's what I'm trying to do with my website, is look at each skeptic argument and then just present what all the evidence is, you know, pertaining to that particular subject.
And how do you do that? So you just hear an argument and then you start looking for evidence?
Yeah, well, how I started the website was I started the database of skeptic arguments. And then I was just curious about which were the most popular arguments. So I just started keeping track of blog posts and mainstream media articles and which arguments they used. And whenever I found one, I just added it to the database and slowly built up a catalogue of which arguments were the most popular. And now I've just been starting at the top and just going down the list. And what I do then is I'll take a skeptic argument and then just try to find out what all the scientific evidence is about this, and read what all the peer-reviewed papers say about it. Can I give an example of one and how I might approach it?
Absolutely.
A popular argument might be that human CO2 emissions are tiny compared to natural emissions. And the way the argument goes is that humans are emitting about 30 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the air each year. But nature, when you look at all the carbon dioxide that plants breathe out and that the ocean emits, it adds up to about 770 billion tons per year. So nature emits heaps more CO2 than we do. So the argument goes, well, how can we make a difference? But if you dig deeper into all the scientific evidence, what you find is that nature doesn't just emit CO2, it absorbs CO2. And when we add up all the CO2 that plants breathe in and all the CO2 that gets dissolved into the oceans, it comes to just over 770 billion tons. So nature is basically in balance, and what we're doing is upsetting the balance. So what I do is I look at the skeptic argument, and then I give the full picture so you can see the skeptic argument in its full context.
Right. So now you're the creator of Skeptical Science, but you're not the only one who works on the site.
No. Well I guess there's only so many hours in the day and so right. so much science to cover. And I often get a lot of visitors on the site and who post comments. And some of them are quite smart and clever. And or they'll post a comment, and I think, that guy knows what he's talking about. And so I'm always looking around for people who can contribute content to the site as well. An example is Professor John Abraham, who recently wrote presented a rebuttal of Christopher Monckton, who is a fairly prominent skeptic who tours the world giving presentations promoting global warming skepticism. And what Professor Abraham did was go through all the claims in Monckton's talk and just examine each of them and track each to its source and then directly contact the source to find out if what Monckton was presenting was accurate. And what he found was that Monckton was consistently misrepresenting what all these scientists were saying. So Professor Abraham put this all into a fantastic presentation on the internet, and a few weeks ago he emailed me just mentioning it, and I said, would you be interested in doing a series of blog posts, just each one looking at one specific argument in Monckton's presentation? And so I'm very happy that he agreed to, and we've just been steadily going through them at the moment.
Well, now this is quite the hobby, sir, because these are extensively researched pieces.
Yeah, well, it does take a bit of time, because you've got to read through the papers, track down the source data, and contact the scientists.
Right.
The good thing is I found that almost all scientists are very approachable, and so when you have questions and you email them, they always get back to you quickly, with very helpful answers. It helps if you suck up to them when you do contact them too. Just say how fascinating their work is. And
do you use the phrase doctor a lot? Keep calling them doctor?
Yeah, whenever I email a scientist, I always try to find out what their title is. So I always start with a dear Professor Abraham or Dr. such and such, just to make sure I'm not over familiarizing myself with them. Yeah, it seems to work. I always seem to get responses. So.
It's difficult for lay people to figure out who the experts are in these areas and where they should go for information. For example, the Oregon Institute of Science and Medicine started something called the Petition Project. And according to their website, 31,000 scientists have signed a petition saying that they doubt that man-made climate change is occurring. So 31,000 sounds impressive.
Yeah, it does sound impressive on face value, I guess, mm-hmm. a petition like that. But the important thing about those kind of surveys is what is each scientist's expertise in climate science. Like, you wouldn't ask a doctor to build a bridge. You'd ask an engineer. I guess you wouldn't ask a doctor what his position on climate science is, because he has no expertise in that. And when you look at those surveys, you find that there are actually very few climate scientists in it. Probably the best survey I've seen is one actually published in a peer-reviewed journal, which surveyed a whole range of scientists, asking them if they thought humans were significantly changing global temperatures. And I can't remember the figure, but it was something like 60 or 70% of all the scientists thought that humans were changing climate. But the interesting thing about the survey was they categorized the scientists based on their skill levels in climate science. And as they got more and more skilled in climate science, the percentage rose. So that by the time you got up to climate scientists who were actively publishing peer-reviewed climate papers, like doing research now, over 97% of those climate scientists thought that humans were significantly changing climate. So, yeah, when you ask the people, the experts in the field, there's a fairly clear consensus.
So that's different than the Petition Project, really. Quite a different response.
Yeah, well, I guess the Petition Project is going for quantity over quality.
What you're saying is there is consensus, mostly, around climate science.
Well, there is, yes, among, you know, climate experts.
Right.
But to me, like, there's a lot of talk about consensus, but to me, I'm personally more interested in evidence and what scientific evidence is, because, like, scientists all have their opinions, but you have to be able to back it up with evidence. And so to me, the ultimate source of, you know, where I get my information is peer-reviewed papers, because for this, a scientist has to be able to take evidence, measurements from the real world, and then publish it in a paper, and then the paper has to survive the scrutiny of other experts in the field. So if it can get through all that, then, yeah, that's the most reliable source of scientific information to me.
We have an email.
From Mystic99, there are basically only 4 active publishing climatologists who doubt anthropogenic global warming. How do you address their criticisms in a way that doesn't come across as censoring debate?
Well, I guess you have to look at what their scientific arguments are. The other thing is, with science, you have to look at the full body of evidence. Probably one of those 4 scientists that they're talking about is Richard Lindzen, who believes that climate sensitivity is quite low. In other words, he's saying that, yes, carbon dioxide in the air does cause warming, but lots of negative feedbacks are going to cancel that out. And he's published a paper recently in a peer-reviewed journal, which was said to give evidence for that. But when you take this one paper and then compare it to all the research on climate sensitivity, there are actually like many different lines of evidence looking at Earth's past, looking at ocean heat, looking at satellite measurements that all find that our climate has positive feedback, that when we add heat, positive feedbacks amplify the warming. So, yeah, I guess it's a bit of a long answer, but I guess the response is to look at the full body of evidence and look at all the peer-reviewed papers. And then that gives you context for each of these individual scientists' arguments.
And I think that's part of the issue, is because people don't necessarily feel that they have access to all of that information. And even if they do have access, they wouldn't necessarily understand it. And then it doesn't help when things, like a while back, there was a scandal over some emails from climate scientists. I believe it was called ClimateGate.
Yes. Well, the thing about ClimateGate was all the fuss was about like 1 or 2 pieces of climate data, the surface temperature record and the hockey stick record. But these are just like 2, if you step back and put this in context, these are just like 2 pieces of data amongst tens of thousands of lines of evidence that humans are causing global warming. Like, we have ice sheets are melting and oceans are warming and glaciers are retreating and species are migrating all over the world and seasons are advancing, like spring is coming earlier each year. So, like, people were saying, these ClimateGate emails show that it totally discredits the whole of climate science.
Right.
But, firstly, it only looked at a tiny little aspect of climate science. And secondly, when you actually look at all the emails in context and try to get a scientific understanding of the issues that they're talking about, they don't say the things that a lot of people are actually trying to get from them.
Well, it was investigated, correct?
Well, there's been like a number of different investigations in a number of different countries, and there's been no misconduct found. And if you read the emails, you can see that for yourself, because what the scientists are doing, they're just talking about issues that have been openly discussed in the peer-reviewed science for over a decade. There's nothing new revealed from the emails. You don't have to hack a climate scientist's email server to find out what they think. They've already published it in journals.
So why are some people still insisting that these emails show some kind of conspiracy to fabricate global warming data?
I guess you'd have to ask the people who say that. But I think there is a very strong willingness to believe that there's a conspiracy here, because, like I said, there's a whole, you know, there's thousands of lines of evidence showing that humans are causing global warming. So if you don't believe in global warming, then there's only two alternatives for you. Either all these scientists are making an honest mistake that all points in the one direction, or they're all conspiring to fudge their evidence to mislead us. So I guess people opt for the second option, opt for the conspiracy theory.
It's more exciting.
Yeah, well, everyone loves a good conspiracy theory.
Audience, if you have questions about climate change, John Cook is your man. Email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So I'm wondering, are there actually certain details that climate scientists don't agree about?
Oh, yeah. Well, there are areas of climate science that are not as well understood as others. And that's an important thing to understand. Like, there are certain parts of climate science that is well understood. We know, for instance, that CO2 causes warming, and we can directly measure the effect of it. We can directly measure how much heat is being trapped, and it matches very closely with our simulations. So that's an area of high understanding. An area of low understanding is aerosols, for instance, like pollution that we put into the air, both soot aerosols and also sulfate aerosols. What they do is they can cause cooling by reflecting sunlight that comes down, but they also interact with clouds, which has a whole other complication where clouds can reflect sunlight. They can also trap heat coming up from the surface. So the role of aerosols with cloud and how they affect global temperatures is less well understood than the role of carbon dioxide.
Well, let's dig into some of the specific arguments that you tackle on the site. I know we've all heard this one because this is the one I hear the most, is solar cycles cause global warming, not us. So what's that argument about?
The basis of the argument, I think, is like sun big, me small, I think is how I would sum it.
That was apt, so, sir.
When you look up into the sky and you see this huge fiery ball and think, well, how could we have an impact compared to that? And it's true that the sun produces like almost all of the energy in our climate. But the way that sun drives climate change is when the solar output changes, when the amount of sunlight that the sun's radiating changes over time. And the sun has changed in the past. A few centuries ago, the sun went through a relatively cool period, and that coincided with a cool period on the Earth. And in the early 20th century, the sun was warming a bit, and at the same time, global temperatures were going up as well. And the sun is believed to have contributed to that. So, looking at the past, we've seen times when the sun has driven climate. But since the 1950s, solar output has been relatively flat, and it's actually been going slightly downwards, like cooling over the last couple of decades, to the point where in 2009, the sun was at its lowest level in over a century. And 2009 also happened to be the second hottest year on record. So for the last couple of decades, the sun and climate have been going in opposite directions. The sun's been cooling slightly while the Earth's been warming.
Okay, I think what I'm going to do is give you a bunch of different arguments, the ones especially that we read about in the news.
Not all at once, I hope.
Oh, no, I'm not mean. The hockey stick paper, it's brought up constantly as an example of something that's been debunked.
Yeah, well, the hockey stick paper was a paper that came out in 98 that showed that over the last 1,000 years, temperatures have been pretty flat and then suddenly just shot up in the last century. And there was a statistical criticism of the paper a few years ago, which said that there was mistakes in the way they did their statistics. Since that paper came out in 1998, there have been like dozens of other hockey stick papers using different data, using different analyses, like different statistical techniques, and they all find the same thing. They all find that the temperatures, recent temperatures, have been the warmest in over 1,000 years, and that the current rate of temperature rise has been the steepest in the last 1,000 or 2 years. So, yeah, the hockey stick the hockey stick paper was like one paper written, you know, over a decade ago. And right. since then, it's like been replaced by a hockey team. But it kind of reminds me of a football team that might have won a game, you know, a decade ago, and they haven't won anything since. But they're still reliving their past glories. So there was this critique made of this one paper back in 98. And since then, they just like to relive that past glory, forgetting that since then the science has moved on. You know, there's many different lines of evidence showing the same thing as that first paper.
I would like you to complete the rest of the interview using only analogies. So another argument that that pops up is that as recently as the 1970s, scientists were actually predicting that we were headed for an ice age. So, and obviously scientists can't make up their minds, so why would we listen to them now?
Okay, well, one way to work out whether the scientists were predicting an ice age is to actually look at the research at the time. And when you look at the peer-reviewed papers about whether what's going to happen after the 70s, the overwhelming majority of them said that we're about to, you know, we're going to experience global warming because carbon dioxide is going up. You know, this was before the modern warming trend began, and scientists were already saying, hey, all this carbon dioxide, it's going to have an effect. That's just not true that scientists were saying that we were predicting an ice age in the past. There were a few papers that speculated that if we keep doing this one type of pollution, you know, if we like put 10 times as much pollution into the air, not carbon dioxide pollution, but sulfate pollution, then that could eventually lead to an ice age over thousands of years. But that didn't happen. We cut down on our sulfate pollution. And, yeah, so I guess the simple answer is the vast majority of scientists or scientific papers were predicting warming, not an ice age.
So was this just like a media-made perception then?
Yeah, well, when people say 1970s ice age predictions, they always quote the New York Times or Newsweek or media article, or Times magazine, I think. So, yeah, they don't, you know, there's only a couple of science papers that publish these. And if you actually read the science papers that did talk about cooling, you know, they put a lot of conditions on how it would cool, and those conditions didn't come to pass.
We have a question from the chat room.
This is from Luxloy. It is, when you do a Google search for global warming, the second site listed is globalwarming.org. Is the problem one of politics and not science?
Is the problem one of what? Sorry?
Is the problem one of politics and not science?
Okay. Yeah, unfortunately, politics does intrude upon science a lot when it comes to global warming. Like those examples of people I know who their political view leads to their science view. What I do on Skeptical Science is I just ban any talk of politics, because what we're trying to do is answer a purely scientific question, which is what's causing global warming. And it's a, you know, you, only science can answer that question. So, yeah, it would be wonderful if everyone could just use scientific evidence to come to a conclusion and keep the politics out of it. But I guess we're only human.
You can email us your climate change questions at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So we should actually probably talk about the difference between weather and climate, because in Alberta, we get snow for approximately 11 months of the year. And whenever there's an unseasonably cold day or a really heavy snowfall or some such, you hear people say that that's evidence against global warming. So can we just clear this up once and for all, perhaps?
Okay. The best way I find to understand the difference between weather and climate is I think of weather as throwing a dice. When you throw a dice, it's completely random what result you get. Just as and weather is also chaotic and somewhat random. Some days you get a hot day, some days you get a cold day. Now, climate is weather averaged over time. So when you throw a dice, you don't know if you're going to get a six or a one. It's random. But if you throw a dice 1,000 times, you know that, you know, to make the sums easier, let's say you throw a dice 6,000 times, you know that you'll get roughly 1,000 ones, 1,000 sixes, and so on. So global warming is like weighting the dice. Just say you put a weight in the dice so that six comes more often. When you throw the dice, it's still random whether it's a one or a six, but the odds of getting a six are more often. And then statistically, you'll get more sixes. So global warming is weighting the weather so that we're more likely to get hotter days. The way the human mind works is we tend to just remember the extremes, the really hot days or the really cold days. But and even when global warming is happening, we will experience record cold days, but over time we'll get those less and we'll get record hot days more often.
And we'll be right back with more John Cook and climate change right after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, pharmacist and blogger Scott Guevara returns to discuss the hyperbole and hype about vitamins. Various pills and powders promise a wide range of health benefits. Scott will give us the evidence-based perspective on these claims and tell us who's watching to see if this multi-billion dollar industry might just be overselling itself. And on Speaking Up, engineering professor Steve Wehrli gives us the real numbers on the Gulf Coast oil spill. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm here with John Cook, the creator of SkepticalScience.com, and we're taking an evidence-based look at climate change arguments. So, John, I don't know if you've heard about the group here in Alberta, Friends of Science.
I have heard of them, actually,
oh,
yes.
Good.
They're quite well known in the climate debate.
So what they do is provide... Well, they say they provide insight into climate change, but what they also do is provide a lot of links to papers and articles that deny human-caused climate change. And one of their main claims is that the weather is not becoming more violent, and it just seems that way. So is that just perception, or is the weather becoming crazy, really?
Yeah, that's a hard question, and there's certain different elements to it. One thing we do know is that we're experiencing more heavy rain events. As temperatures get warmer, you get more evaporation so that there's more moisture in the air. And what goes up eventually must come down. So over the last century, we found that we're seeing more rain and we're also seeing more heavy rain incidents. It's like an empirical observation that we're experiencing more heavy rain and flooding events. So as to the question of tornadoes and hurricanes, that's a harder issue. The evidence seems to indicate that the number of hurricanes is not changing, but that we're seeing stronger hurricanes. So, yeah, but that's still an area of uncertainty.
We have a question from the website.
Much has been said lately about crank magnetism, the idea that those who cross the line from skepticism to denialism are more likely to do so in more than one area. An example is the overlap between anti-vaccine groups and those doubting the HIV/AIDS link. To what extent do you see this tendency as being a matter of coincidence, for example, due to an overarching political ideology or religious view, versus a bleed-through of conspiratorial thinking in general that prevents them from properly evaluating scientific information? And that's from Ryan.
That's a big question. Well, I guess firstly, there's a bit of psychology and politics involved, which I'm not really an expert in. But I guess for all the various movements that deny science, they all have a few traits in common. And one of those is a tendency to think that there's a big conspiracy to among scientists to mislead us. And like we talked before about how that's almost inevitable. If there's a scientific consensus, the only alternative really, if you disagree with it, is to think that there must be a big conspiracy. Another sort of common trait among these type of movements is cherry picking, because if all the scientific evidence points to a coherent answer, the only way you can get an alternative answer is just to pick little bits of data in isolation while ignoring the full picture. So yeah, I probably couldn't really answer to why all these movements have something in common, but I guess if you are going to deny science, then it does sort of force you down a certain route, and there's only certain ways that you can do it.
Well, you actually wrote a piece called The Five Characteristics of Scientific Denialism, and you mentioned it was quite popular.
Yes. Most of the content on my site is just about scientific evidence, but I read this really interesting paper that looked at all these different denial movements and found that they had these traits in common, the conspiracy theories, the cherry picking, etc. And it was just a very illuminating in terms of understanding the tactics that climate change skeptics use. So I published this on my website, just summarizing the results of that paper. And yeah, it was very popular. Like after I posted it, I found heaps of links to the site, and Senator John Kerry from the States, he has a website about climate change, and they asked to use that article on their website. So in a sense, I found it a little bit annoying that people were much more interested in talking about the characteristics of skepticism and less about the scientific evidence itself. I'm much more interested in the evidence and getting to the truth of science. But I guess that's just what people like to talk about.
Well, do you think that we like to discuss that more philosophical aspect of it because the majority of us don't have a background in science, and especially much less climate science, but we still want to help?
I guess so, yeah. I guess it's easier to characterize a person rather than to analyze all their arguments, with which you almost need to be an expert to pick apart all the technical things. So I guess it's just the natural way that we approach things is to look at the person more than their argument, perhaps.
We have another question from the website.
My question has a few parts. Some say we're too late, we're past the point of no return and can't reverse the impending doom of climate change. Is this true? If not, how would we know when we have reached this point? Last, if when we do reach this point, how do we cope? Has anyone ever started on a strategy for that possibility? And that's from Trevor.
Okay, well, the first part...
That's huge. That is a huge question.
All right, I'll start by answering the first part, and I may have forgotten the other parts by the time I finished answering.
We may
I'll
run out of time it. On the show before you finish answering.
That's right. So what was the first part again? It was is it too late? With global warming, it's not a yes or no thing. It's not either it's going to be a big disaster or it's not. There's degrees. And, you know, the warmer it gets, the worse the impacts on humanity. And so we have already committed to nearly a degree of warming even at this point, even if we stopped emit carbon dioxide emissions completely right now. So we are going to have impacts regardless. The question is, how bad is it going to be? And how bad it will be will depend on our actions over the next few decades. So to me, there's no point in throwing our hands up and saying, oh, let's give up. There's no point. There's every point, because if we give up, it'll just be worse. But if we work at it now, then it will be less worse. Like, we can control, well, to some extent, the amount of impacts.
I'm going to actually start using the phrase less worse.
I was going to say better, but I thought
no. I like less worse.
Yeah.
Before we go, I do want to hear a bit about your iPhone app, because I think this is amazing.
Yeah, well, late last year, I got an email from a software company in Melbourne, and the two owners of the company just said they're passionate about climate, and they wanted to create an app summarizing all the content on my website. And I thought this was great for two reasons. One was because, you know, it's really important to get the scientific evidence out there to the, you know, easily accessible to the public. And so much of this debate is about politics or attacking scientists or whatever, when it needs to be about evidence. So an iPhone app was an ideal way to make that happen. And secondly, because I love iPhones, I thought it was pretty cool. So, and they offered to do it for free, and they offered to and make it freely available so people can download the app for free. And it came out in March, a couple of months ago now. As soon as it came out, there was a big reaction to it. It was really popular. But the other interesting reaction was all the people who didn't use iPhones calling out me too. So
I noticed that. You just did a Nokia app as well.
Yeah. So that was just a guy who said he uses a Nokia phone, and there was just a website that creates fairly simple apps quite easily. So he just put that together. The most popular, other than iPhone, request was for Android apps, and they've actually been working on that for the last few months, and it should be finished over the next week or two, I think. I just got an Android phone for myself, so I can check it out. So I'm looking forward to seeing an Android app, hopefully next week sometime.
Well, congratulations on all of this, and thank you, because this is something that we've been needing for a while.
That's my pleasure.
And that's our time. So thanks for being here, John.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And you can find John's site at skepticalscience.com. And we are, as always, at skepticallyspeaking.com. We encourage you to comment on the site, to click the links to Facebook, Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
On Skeptically Speaking, we discuss a wide range of skeptical and science topics with a variety of experts. But I'd like to remind you that you, yes, you personally, are invited to join us on air every week for Speaking Up. Because let's face it, outreach is a part of skepticism. We all do it, whether we're talking to our parents about why they shouldn't buy into that multi-level marketing scheme, explaining the misinformation around vaccines to our coworkers, or forwarding that Snopes entry on why typing in your PIN number backward on the ATM machine does not, in fact, summon the police. But if you want to take your skeptical activism one step further and reach a broader audience, we're here for you. Do you have an event coming up that you'd like to promote? Or maybe you're a blogger that's been doing some great work and you'd like to talk about it? Or you'd just like to get some experience speaking publicly on a science or skeptical topic? What better way to get some real-world practice than on a friendly, rational radio show? If you're ready to have your say, do send an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Put Speaking Up in the subject line, tell us a bit about what you'd like to discuss, and we'll contact you to set up your very own 10 to 15 minutes of on-air goodness. We're looking forward to hearing from you.